Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Peel's foe, not a set animal, laminates a tone of sleep.
And say that again, Andy.
Peel's foe, not a set animal, laminates a tone of sleep.
So that backwards is exactly the same
thing. Exactly
it's
the
a palindrome.
Same. It's a palindrome, and it comes from Peter Blegvad from his album Q.Rhone. And it's the longest palindrome ever made, as far as I know.
Very good. Very good.
Isn't that so impressive?
Andy Gill, welcome to the pod. Fraser's back from the South Seas,
hello.
Aren't you?
Wow.
Rested and refreshed from the Rugby World Cup, of which more later.
Yeah.
Mark Ellen's here, and we're going to settle the issue that was discussed on the website this week about who had the longest hair in rock.
Oh, right, that's been settled. It's still going on.
More of that later.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about groups reforming. But I wanted Andy Gill, to be here this week, because this is the week that the Beach Boys' Smile is issued for the first time in its entirety, allegedly, which Andy reviewed in the current issue of The Word. And Andy, a bit of a student of the Beach Boys. And I thought it's a good subject. It's one of those things that hovers over pop music, isn't it?
It is.
The story of Smile.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is a good opportunity to set it to rights, right?
Okay, yeah.
So, Andy, tell us the story of Smile, pretty much from the beginning.
Well, the beginning, I suppose you have to start with Pet Sounds, and where Brian's getting more and more sophisticated in his approach to music, much to the Beach Boys' chagrin. And then he goes and becomes completely bonkers and does Good Vibrations. And
which took 3 months to record.
Took something. Estimates vary.
Major
6 months. Yeah,
six months.
Four major studios.
Four studios
At a cost
$16,000. $16,000. Am I right?
$60,000. I think it is.
Which at the time was a fortune.
It's a crazy amount of money to spend on.
No, it was 50. It was $15,000. Just on something to do with the theremin, wasn't it? Didn't he have a theremin
probably.
On it? And it wasn't the rental and an operation of the theremin on a huge budget, and we're off on a tangent here.
No, fair enough. Yeah.
But he was, oddly enough, he was never sure about whether it was successful until David Anderley, the famous Los Angeles scene maker and record company functionary who was he worked with A&M, I believe, ran A&M at one point, ran Elektra in LA at one point, and he was the man that they got in to start running Brother Records a year before the Beatles started Apple. And he was never sure. Brian was never sure about Good Vibrations, whether it was successful or not. And then David Anderley heard it, and he was managing Danny Hutton, later of Three Dog Night. And he thought, maybe I can get this for Danny. And so he called Brian and said, "Can I have this for Danny Hutton?"
Well, he wanted Danny Hutton to record the Vibrations.
Yes. And
just start again and do it.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary.
And Brian goes, well, maybe it's not that, not that weird. And so that's what persuaded him to actually.
So Brian Wilson, first of all, when he made Good Vibrations, thought this is too strange to release.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Because all the Beach Boys were saying, "What's going on here?"
Really?
But surely, if I remember rightly, they're off touring, aren't they?
He's in the
studio making these incredibly complicated symphonic recordings, and when they come back, they, as you say, they're a lot of them. Very, very volubly appalled, aren't they? I mean,
absolutely.
Mike Love, doesn't Mike Love call it ego music? Well, your ego music.
Yeah, your ego music.
And so it must be really odd, because they're off there playing the old simple songs on European tours, and they come back, and there's this absolutely extraordinary thing, all recorded, apart from the vocal parts, which he's expecting them to record, which in themselves are immensely complicated.
Which they did.
Which they did.
And they did them beautifully.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there are apparently extant recordings that with Brian doing all the vocal parts, but then he goes and gives the lead part to Carl again, which he'd done with God Only Knows.
So Good Vibrations is eventually released and is a huge hit, in Europe.
Yeah.
Was it a huge hit in the States?
It was a big hit in the States. It sold, in America, it sold 100,000 sales every day for the first week, which was big in those days. And it were it, and in those days, records didn't go straight to number one. They crept up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it became number one by Christmas.
I can remember, I can remember this record coming out in Britain. And I was living in Yorkshire and I was at school. And I was happened to be homesick with a cold for a few days, or flu, man flu, boy flu.
Boy flu.
And this is in the days of pirate radio. And I can't remember what the station was that we could pick up there. It was something that came out of the North Sea, identified by a number, I think. And they played this record literally three times an hour when it came out. And on this crackly transistor that you pretty much had to hold at a certain angle at the window to get a signal. I can remember it now, the kind of the chills of hearing that record. Well, there'd never been
anything like it.
Yeah.
and every time you got to hear it, you slowly built up more and more of a picture of it in your head. And so you could kind of last the 20 minutes until the next play by playing it in your head.
Completely.
And it still has that effect on me now, you know, 40 years later or whatever.
The thing is, what made it so different was that Brian had discovered this new means of recording, or new method of recording, which is the modular process, whereby you get, you know, separate modules of sound, which if you listen to the Smile Sessions, you've got a whole CD of these little modules for Good Vibrations, and you've got another CD of the little modules for Heroes and Villains.
I don't quite understand this. What are these modules?
He'd be working on one little bit of the music, and then he'd get an idea for something else. And everybody that's worked with him says, the thing about Brian is he's got to have it done instantly. If he has to wait to get something, if he has to wait to book a studio or something, it just goes.
The idea
goes. It's got to be done instantly. And so on. And so he'd instantly move from what he's working on to this new piece. And then there'll be another piece, and so on, and he'd record
which
all
might not finish up in that song.
Might not be in the same.
Can you imagine? And he's got to get the smoke in the bottle.
And if you listen to listen to these CDs, there's like 30, 40 pieces, and so on. And it takes him all this time. Took him 6 months to a year to edit down and finally come up with a mix for Good Vibrations, which when we hear it for the first time, it's like nothing we've ever heard before, because it's jumping around all over the place. It's got
different
songs. It's suddenly into this
together.
Bit, and then suddenly everything
different
drops out, and it's just this humming noise, and so on. And we think, wow, that's the strangest thing I've ever heard. And then after that, it becomes quite normal. Nowadays, we hear it and we think, that's great, that's Good Vibrations. But
isn't it a case that we've heard it millions of times,
exactly.
And therefore it's formed itself in our head.
Exactly, that's what I mean, yeah.
Into something that it wasn't at the first place.
Exactly, so it's sort of like this new principle. When he comes to do Heroes and Villains, it takes him even longer, because there's even more bits, and they keep going off on these weird tangents, and he's working with Van Dyke Parts.
Yes, I'm going to say, so tell us about Van Dyke Parts, because Van Dyke Parts, who sat where you're sitting now in the pod not long ago, was visitor to this podcast, never to be forgotten. That was a key meeting, wasn't it, Brian Wilson and Van Dyke Parts?
Absolutely, and do you know where that first meeting took place?
Go on.
Yeah, go on.
It took place at Terry Melcher's house.
Oh, yeah. Doris Day's son.
Doris Day's son, and the location shortly afterwards of the Sharon Tate murder.
Of the murders.
Oh my God,
the
that's
Manson
right.
family murder.
Yeah.
And they met on the lawn of that very mansion. And they were introduced by David Anderley, apparently, according to one account. Brian was immediately impressed by Van Dyke's way with words.
As anybody would be.
Now, tell us the story of... They fell out over the recording of Cabin Essence, I think. Am I right or not? There was
not
one
sure
particular song where he had written a line that Brian couldn't understand, and he asked him to explain it, and he refused to explain it.
There were lines in I think the big break, it was on Surf's Up.
Oh, right.
And it was Mike Love, and he, you know, Van Dyke gets a call, and Brian's in the studio and Mike Love's there, and they've obviously come back off tour again.
Yeah.
And they've found, you know, Dove Nested Towers, The Hours Would Strike, The Straight Quicksilver Moon, Carriage Across the Fog, Two Step, The Lamplight, Cellar Tune.
It's another palindrome.
It's not exactly round, round, get around, I get around.
It's not. It's Helping Rhonda. And
it's not a little Honda.
Barbara.
And apparently Mike Love had come to the line Columnated Ruins Domino.
Columnated Ruins Domino.
Oh, here we go. This is good.
And he said to Brian, what's going on here? And Brian was obviously in such a state that he just thought, I can't be bothered to argue this. And anyway, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I didn't write it.
And so they call Van Dyke up, and Van Dyke has to come down to the studio, and Mike Love's like, so what do you mean by this? And Van Dyke apparently refused to explain. He says, it's what it is, you know.
Because he didn't know how to explain.
Well, possibly. It. Although, you know, you can. It's quite, you know, an elusive, interesting image, you know, columnated room. It's about, you know, the fall of empires.
Right, right.
And kind of a domino. Yeah,
but also, the best possible pop lyrics don't have an absolute answer.
Exactly.
If you don't have a little bit of manoeuvre for mystery, there's not much point in writing them, you know.
Exactly.
But Brian was basically so impressed by Van Dyke because he could just, words just came out of him, whereas Brian had never really written words, had he?
Brian is not a word man, and that's part of the problem with Smile, was that when he and Van Dyke sort of fell out, he was left with this album, which had several tracks done in this very ornate Rococo kind of imagery.
And then bits that were just la-la-la.
Moon, June.
Well, a whole load of
Kissing
tracks.
Kissing Missing.
A whole load of tracks, frankly, which were just backing tracks.
Right.
And still awaiting lyrics
in
many cases. And they just end up as these bits of what are effectively incidental music now. And
he's aware when he's working on it that he's doing something that's massively ambitious and that nobody has ever gone where he's gone before.
Absolutely,
and it's very interesting, the point you make about Good Vibrations, which I'd never thought about before, that when he'd made it, he thought, this is strange. He didn't think, this is the big sound that's going to change the world. And that must be a major adjustment. When you've done something you think is really experimental, it turns out really popular.
And it turned out to be popular, which strengthens his resolve to be even stranger.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the best.
But he must have been worrying all the time about whether it was going to be the right thing or not. He had nothing to measure it against.
Absolutely, I'm sure he was. But he also, at that point, started to have this retinue of friends around him. And like all pop stars do, they're saying, that's great.
Yes, go further. Yes,
yeah.
That's
oh, you're
so
really
weird.
On the money.
So
and so on. And there was also a documentary made at that time, which was hosted by Leonard Bernstein, from which comes the famous footage of Brian at the piano alone doing Surf's Up. And basically, Leonard Bernstein doesn't actually say he was a genius, but he kind of inferred that there was some, you know, there was some...
So some PR man thought, genius, Bernstein.
And this became a kind of like, you know, the bestowal of
So in a very short period of time, he suddenly shot into this position that he never particularly sought, isn't he?
No.
You know, he's been a kind of really good songwriter for a really good group, and suddenly he's an artist, isn't he?
Exactly, exactly that. And
which must have been terrifying.
And so he's wanting to make a teenage symphony to God, as he calls Dumb Angel, which was the original title for Smile.
So that was the original name for it?
Dumb Angel.
Dumb Angel. That's Dumb extraordinary. Angel. Yeah. And so while he's making this record, I was actually looking at this book called Beach Boys FAQ, All That's Left to Know About America's Band by John Stebbins, which comes out right now, I think, and brings together loads of the folklore about Beach Boys. And I was reading this last night, and I'd never fully been struck by the relationship between this and what the Beatles were doing. And so he's halfway through this in 66, 67, isn't he?
Absolutely.
It's the winter of 66.
Yeah.
And in February, it's all going well, and then the Beatles put out Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane. And he must have thought, oh, my God.
But it goes right back to,
and then
the story
and
starts.
And then they put out Sgt. Pepper.
Well, in the summer.
And that's the capper. It's
a combination of the two, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, because he's aware that he's doing something experimental and strange.
Mm-hmm.
But the Beatles, in the middle of it, dropped something experimental and strange that's also massively commercial. You know, the first time you hear those records, Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, they don't sound strange.
No. This
they
begins
just, they just
with Rubber
so
Soul.
Punch to them.
Yeah. Rubber Soul's where it starts, I'm pretty sure.
Rubber Soul.
He hears Rubber Soul, and he says that Rubber Soul, what's amazing about Rubber Soul is I think it's the first Beatles record without a non-Beatles composition on it. I think it's all written by the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
Apologies if I've got that wrong.
Hard Day's Night, actually,
the viewers. But anyway, it's what he said was no filler. He said that he'd grown up in a business model that was few singles, loads of filler. It was understood the way they did it. And he didn't think there was any filler on Rubber Soul. So he thought, right, OK, I see your Rubber Soul. I raise you this.
Pet Sounds.
So Pet Sounds comes out with absolutely no filler on it. And then, as you say, then we get into this cycle of... And also, it's so fascinating that the way the two acts are working is so completely different, because he's up against this collaborative unit of the Beatles,
exactly.
Which is so interesting. Not only are they collaborative, one of them comes and says, I've written this song, the others then, the co-writer, if they have one, helps write it, and then the four of them bolt it together. Mm. He is not only using, probably, was it the Wrecking Crew?
He was using the Wrecking Crew
to play all the instruments. He's using himself to dub in the demo guide vocal tracks, and then he's having to use his own vocalists, who are off in Europe, you know, passing the hat around, still playing Barbara Ann, to come back and finish it off. So it's just a completely different way of working, and he can't compete because the Beatles are so much faster. And
well, there's more of them.
And there are more of them.
Even if you look at, you know, even if we accept that Ringo's not the most creative musician in the world, George Martin is a creative
musician.
And there's three other Beatles who are pretty damn creative as well. And
so the time Sergeant Pepper came out, I remember there was a whole story saying, do you realise they've spent 200 hours in the studio making this record, or whatever it was, 500. It's the kind of thing, George Michael spends 200 hours doing a B-side nowadays. Yeah. You know? Whereas at the time, it seemed an immense amount of
extraordinary
time.
Amount
it was
of
nothing
time.
Compared to the time that Brian Wilson had been spending at the same time.
And also, he was doing it on his own, and the people in his band with him were giving him grief about it.
Yes.
There was no kind of support for him. There was no encouragement. So he was constantly fighting this tide of, on his own, swimming upstream, whereas the Beatles were all kind of like coasting down a water slide together.
So were the Beatles, how much were they aware of that? Because there was a story. Van Dyke Parks told me, didn't he? Didn't the Beatles get played? No, he was in the studio, that's right.
Derek Taylor
when
played it, I think.
Derek Taylor played the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper to Brian. Gosh, I can't remember what he said now, because it's a long time since we did that podcast, but that's an extraordinary moment. And this is obviously has a very destabilising effect. Probably a deliberate ruse on Derek's part. But then, so does that make... Here's my question to you. Does that make, back in the USSR, opening track of the White Album, a cruel twist by McCartney, or just an affectionate, I thought we were still playing this game of tennis? Because that's an absolutely... If in the light of all this, that was a pretty mean thing to do, which is not only are we better, but we can be the Beach Boys. We can actually be you.
Maybe. I think it was probably kind of like he thought, friendly rivalry.
Yeah.
Thumbs aloft,
yeah.
Friendly rivalry. Doesn't Derek Taylor, and we're talking about the late, great Derek Taylor, who was the Beatles and the Birds and all sorts of people's PR man, and was probably the first great kind of PR man in rock. He has a key part in this, doesn't he? Because he knew all about the Beach Boys camp. And wasn't he the guy who said in print, Brian Wilson cannot finish Smile? I think he actually says this. And so it goes into the public domain that he can't actually come to an end of it.
You may be right, because I know Derek Taylor was instrumental in the Brian is a Genius thing as well.
That was probably a brilliant piece of PR on his part, realising what catastrophe was round the corner. I mean, at that point, Brian has completely unravelled as a human being. We can say that, can't we?
Yeah.
And, goes on later to be entirely supported and taken over by the Evil Doctor, which we probably won't get on to in this podcast.
He doesn't believe in the Evil Doctor.
Oh, you don't believe what? No,
I met Dr. Landy. I interviewed Dr. Landy.
Did you?
I got on really well with Dr. Landy, yeah. He
brainwashed you, Andy. You taking the meds.
My doctor, it's great. No, he was fine. I asked him about it, because at the time, it was when Brian's solo album came out.
I remember, which I think Dr. Eugene Landy we're talking about here was the kind of psychotherapist who took over Brian's life, really. And obviously, on one level, helped him lose weight and get off drugs, but on another level, appeared to exert an enormous amount of control of his own life, to the extent that he is, in fact, listed as the co-producer and co-author.
This was his problem. He got struck off by the California Psychiatric Association or whatever professional body.
And that can't be a good thing. No, your best mate, you're a pal, huge. Yeah,
no. Because he was acting as Brian's psychotherapist, his manager, his co-producer, his co-writer, and they said, I'm sorry, this is multiple capacity, you can't do this. It's illegal.
Seems fair.
It seems fair. And I asked the doctor about this, and he said, my only problem, he says, is that I was successful. He said, if I'd been unsuccessful, like any of the other 32 shrinks that the family got in to try and sort Brian out, then, if I'd been that unsuccessful, Brian would be dead, and I wouldn't have this problem. So is that all? My problem is that I was successful and
point.
I managed to get Brian productive again, and that's when my problem started. But, and I thought, that is a reasonable,
it's a reasonable point.
Brian
reasonable.
Wilson is an extraordinary figure, isn't he? In that he is, he's ended up being, and you know, without being too kind of harsh about it, the meal ticket for more people in popular music than anybody else, than any other single individual.
Yeah.
And yet he's clearly not being fitted for this.
No.
He's not robust enough for that.
Did you by any chance see the recent live shows, the Gershwin show?
I didn't see the recent ones. I saw the ones about 7 or 8 years ago.
I saw the Smile show and the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's the same kind of thing, except the Gershwin thing I think is rubbish. But the, you know, you see him live and he's clearly unhappy. He clearly hates being there and he does this kind of like tic-tac man stuff with his hands. He's sitting behind his keyboard and he's doing these...
And reads his spontaneous ad-libs off an auto-cue,
exactly.
I'm afraid to say. I'm sure anyone listening will know that.
He just seems so unhappy to be there.
Yeah, I agree.
He says that he really likes touring. He likes being in the airports. He likes being in the hotels. He doesn't like playing.
It's the reverse of what everyone else says. The cliché is it's worth it for the 90 minutes.
I thought that was really poignant.
Yeah, very
you know,
poignant.
That he doesn't like the pressure of being on the stage.
But he likes the security and the structure of a life where people are running around making sure he's got some breakfast.
Exactly.
You know, which is, and he's costing a hotel.
So, this is a guy who starts off being kind of the meal ticket and kind of important outlet for the aspirations of his very tough father, Murray.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, then moves on to being the meal ticket for his brothers, who are and wider family, and now as a meal ticket for loads of people in the kind of reissue industry and the heritage industry and all the fans, and everybody sort of wants him to be something.
And the meal ticket for the Wonderments, surely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the irony, that he formed a touring group made up of, am I right, the Wonderments, who were
in fact
a Beach Boys tribute act. They were a Beach Boys tribute act in need of a lead singer. He was the lead singer, or one of the lead singers of the Beach Boys, in need of a band.
It's the ultimate win, isn't it, for a tribute band?
Unbelievable.
It's like the bootleg Beatles getting Paul McCartney to join them, isn't it?
Exactly. And,
I'm not sure if a member of the Jam didn't actually do this at one point, but anyway, go on.
I think
I can't remember now.
Didn't the Stone Roses do something? Ian Brown actually went, there was a kind of a Stone Roses.
Oh, we talked more about
tribute,
Stone Roses in.
Oh, yeah, we'll get on
and
that.
And Ian Brown actually played with them.
Was it Genesis or somebody hired somebody from a singer? Meridian.
Yes, have done it, and Judas Priest have done it.
Yes, and Judas Priest both hired a singer from a tribute band because he was the best person.
Yeah,
I think one of the important things about Brian is that I've got a bootleg of the Hamburger songs, which comes from slightly later when he was, Dennis was trying to get Brian out of bed where he'd been for 3 years, and he'd lure him by hamburgers. It was sort of
like a dog.
If he could get Brian to the piano and he'd knock out a tune,
he'd get a quarter
Dennis
pound
would
of
give
cheese.
Him a hamburger. Yeah. Oh. And so Brian would come out and he'd knock out these things, and it's really tragic. But the album is called Adult Child, and that's basically what Brian Wilson is. And at that time that we're talking of, in his Laurel Way home, he had the famous sandbox with the grand piano in it, where the dog used to take its dumps, and Van Dyke refused to set foot in it.
Quite
and
rightly.
At the same time, he had the tree house installed in the hallway of his home, so that anybody entering the house had to crawl through the tree house. Effectively, they had to infantilize themselves.
Michael Jackson,
to enter his world.
Time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's that same thing.
Going
and
back
so,
to the age of six.
There's David Anderley at this time said, Brian's trip was like living Disneyland, which again is Michael Jackson ahead of time.
So they had to go through the treehouse
in order in the
That's
hallway.
A brilliant
in order
psychological to... device.
Exactly.
Isn't it? I never knew that.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So, what do you think of this box set then? Now, Andy, this thing that's just come out—the Smile. This is the full Smile with all the every bit, isn't it?
I thought I was going to love it because I'm a bit of a Brian nut, and I I wanted to hear this stuff. But then when you do actually hear it, it's like an autopsy. It's just, you hear these songs and you just, after a while, you just think, I don't want to hear any more of this. I don't want to hear this bit of session here. And you can tell...
So he's got all the bits that went into making it.
All the bits and so on, and bits of studio chatter and so on. And you can hear that the musicians who are there, and they're normally getting, three tracks done in a session, and they can go away and say on their CV, hey, I played on Hang On Sloopy or whatever,
Yeah.
Here... They're being asked to go over and over, like 50 takes of this tiny fragment of music.
They wouldn't want to do that.
No, they wouldn't want to do that.
Hal Blaine, Campbell wouldn't want to do
and
that.
And you can virtually hear how lackluster their performing is becoming.
Because, they're used to working against the clock, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's an extraordinary thing, which you can see in that wonderful documentary, The Wrecking Crew. You know, these were guys who could just raise their game when somebody said, you've got 10 minutes to do this.
Yeah.
And being given endless time was a real imposition on these guys. They didn't want that.
Yeah, they didn't want that.
And they could be off doing something, making more money somewhere else.
Yeah, they got the same money. They just get bored.
Yeah, they get bored and they'd leave the session thinking, what did we achieve?
And they also probably aren't able to work out what it is they're doing wrong. If they can't they can't figure out in his head what he's after. And they're just giving him various versions.
And there's the vocals. There's one bit in the vocals where they're doing Our Prayer, the intro track to it, and it's a very nice piece of stuff. And this is the boys themselves. And when the engineer calls out at one point, take 60. And you just think, how the hell are they even managing to make a sound if they're on the 60th take, let alone have these pristine harmonies? And one of them, probably Mike, says, why on earth are we wasting, Mike, very money conscious, why on earth are we wasting all this tape? Let's just wipe the previous 59 takes, if they're not good enough, and re-record over it. Because tape in those days cost a lot of money.
Absolutely,
And I came away thinking, well, big respect to the Beach Boys for being able to do that after 60 takes.
Yeah, the discipline.
Absolutely.
What worries me here is that, and these are just all the component parts of the machine unassembled, aren't they? But if Andy Gill, world's leading expert in the Beach Boys obsessive, finds it a bit boring, then who is this record for?
Has it got on this collection, has it got a definitive version?
It does.
Listen to the thing
that's
itself.
That's the saving grace of it. They've got the ultimate definitive mix. And that's what starts the thing. And you hear this definitive mix and it all sounds fantastic and bright and so on. And you think, oh, that's okay. And then it all just starts disassembling and falling apart on you. And you start realising that, hang on, this track that they're doing over and over again, it's just a little bit of nothing really on the album. And you start realising that he's trying to inflate all these tracks to the level of Good Vibrations and Heroes and Villains, and he's never going
to
finish it.
And he's kind of hoping it's going to magically happen, isn't he?
Yeah,
because he doesn't really know how to make it happen himself.
No, and so he's recording all these little modules for each track, and it's just... you can imagine.
Didn't he do a record once with George Martin, or an experimental thing, where they got two tracks, they went back to the master and remixed a version from the master of some of the songs he'd done?
Oh, I don't know. Not sure.
Don't be surprised.
And how does it differ from the Wonderments version that came out a few years ago?
Well, it's got the Beach Boys singing on it.
In terms of the arrangements?
The arrangements, they're not ersatz in the way that, the Wonderments versions have to be ersatz because, they're not. They're played with the post-knowledge of hearing these things for years and years.
Yes.
Whereas the guys that were actually playing them back in 66 were having to figure out what Brian was talking about.
That's a good point.
And
best quote on the 60s I ever got, I interviewed Bill Graham years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, the thing about the 60s you have to understand is we were out there with no compass.
Compass, no maps.
It's a really good point. Yeah.
This is,
they didn't know what the 60s were. They were living through them.
Yeah.
And this is what, it's the same thing that the Floyd said about Sid Barrett. David Anderley says about Brian, clearly in retrospect, Brian was mentally ill. But he says at that time, everybody was whimsical and had weird ideas.
Just thought he was even
and so when he
weird.
Said, when they're sitting down at dinner and everybody tapping their plates in different rhythms, going, "This is great, let's make an album of this." Everybody just thought, this is Brian
He's
being
as stone as we are.
Exactly.
Yeah. The thing I want to just touch on here, which interested me in looking at this book, is that it strikes me there's two Beach Boys careers. There's the actual one that took place largely in the 60s and very early 70s. You were talking earlier, but you saw them in
1972 when I was a teenager. And I was not old enough and aware enough really to know that Brian probably wasn't in the group that I saw.
But
they were actually living in Holland.
they had a new manager. Was it Jack Riley? I think it was something like that.
Yeah.
Who suggested, God knows why, there must have been some tax reason or whatever.
Yes, probably.
Let's relocate.
Let's start the whole thing again.
Of this
Reset
really
the
complicated, Southern Californian soap opera. All the family, all the wives, children, whatever. Let's move to Holland.
It started really well. They made Ceylon Sailor.
Let's build a studio in a barge or something. I don't know. Yeah. And let's make Holland. Now, apparently, when they first made Holland, it didn't have Ceylon Sailor on it. Ceylon Sailor was something they got that they made earlier.
He did with Van Dyke Parks earlier on, I think. That's right.
But anyway, it's an extraordinary idea that they relocated to Europe for about a year or something like that.
Well, I'm sure somebody probably came in and said, let's just start this whole thing. We need a clean sheet of paper, don't we? Because it had gotten such a terrible mess.
But the point I was going to make was that was the real career. And then there was the second career. And the second career, I think, was started by three things. One was a big feature, probably a two-part feature in Rolling Stone magazine, which I think was called The Beach Boys, A California Saga or something, which I remember reading this, which opened with a photograph of Brian Wilson in his dressing gown in the middle of the night in his vegetarian deli.
Yeah.
That he'd opened called the Radiant Radish. The Radiant Radish. And it just proceeded to say, okay, here we are in the Radiant Radish. Here's Brian. Wow, he's strange, isn't he? Yeah. Now let's go back and tell the whole extraordinary saga of the Beach Boys. Not as a story of happiness, which is how we remember it from the first time, but it's a very melancholy, rather sad story of dysfunctional family.
Absolutely.
And everything's very bittersweet. Oh, and then not long afterwards, Nick Kent wrote a big piece in the anime, probably similarly two-part.
Which was
pretty much the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was the release of the first of those massive compilations, Endless Summer.
Endless Summer.
In the States.
Of America as well.
Where suddenly this stuff is sold for the first time as nostalgia. It's kind of gone. But wouldn't you like to be 15 again and listen to Surfing USA and I Get Around and all that kind of stuff? And so ever since you've had this bunch of aging men, and we're all aging men, you know, desperately trying to recapture for the benefit of their audience something from 1965, 1966. And the second career has been way longer than the first one.
Yeah.
Something that they were only tangentially attached to anyway, weren't they? That whole... No, if I can ask Andy this and see. I always understood that the name of the group was the Pendletones.
It started off as the Pendletones.
Which was based on a shirt called the
Candy Stripe Shirt.
Candy Stripe Shirt, and they were called, I think they called the Pendletones. And their first recording, I think, was a song called Surf or Surfin'. And when it came back from the record company, they opened the boxes to discover the sleeves billed them as a group called the Beach Boys.
Oh, they never heard that before?
Which I think Murray had invented.
I don't think they knew anything about that.
Yeah,
and, therefore, they were now lumbered with the title. They said, we're the Pendletones. And he said, no, this is a surfing song. It's the whole surfing thing's really happening. At least one of you surfed. I think Dennis was a surfer. You are the Beach Boys. So from the very beginning, from literally day one, they're in that, Brian is in that tangle of this, what is control? It's quite interesting, I think.
And so,
it's quite serious.
So now there are a bunch of, you know, the survivors are a bunch of guys in what, their late 60s?
Yeah.
If not, probably their 70s, my love, I don't know. Still the Beach Boys.
From the Beach, not even the Beach Men.
They are still the Beach Boys. Yeah. And they've still got this thing hanging around their neck, you know. Yeah. And no doubt they're kind of descendants and so forth, you know, and everybody's benefiting from it. I'll tell you another thing I found in this book, Beach Boys FAQ, which seems to me a fantastic emblem of how everything Beach Boys gets mythologized. Tony Asher, who was the lyricist who worked with Brian Wilson before Van Dyke Parks, who wrote loads of stuff, co-wrote loads of stuff on Pet Sounds and stuff, and was an advertising man, I think he was. You know, he was an advertising copywriter. He was no great mystic or anything like this. And the tune he wrote, that Brian was working on a tune, and Asher came up with these lyrics about an old girlfriend of his called Carol. And the refrain was, oh, Carol, I know. And Brian's wife is called Caroline. Heard some demo of this and thought, oh, how sweet,
oh,
darling,
sweet.
You've written a song about me.
Oh, you shouldn't have. I didn't.
And so Brian, you know, no man alive would deny that.
Absolutely.
He'd go, yes, darling.
Did the right thing.
Yes, oh, you've got my secret.
Yeah.
And so ever since, this thing is known as Caroline No, even though it started as Caroline No.
Brilliant.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
Go on.
I was just going to say, a thing to remember about Brian is that, you know, he was on the treadmill from being a teenager.
Yeah.
Capital had him cranking out up to three albums a year, and that's writing, producing, arranging, the whole lot. He basically lived in the studio and became a, you know, like he had that studio tan going on, I guess, from the time he was about 18 or 19. And they just kept him on that treadmill.
But now he's on another kind of treadmill.
Now he's on another kind of treadmill.
He's the play life.
I did ask him once, I said, you know, didn't you feel that they were kind of like taking advantage of you? And he said, oh, no, I really like it because I really felt at home in the studio.
It's a very good impersonation, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And,
slightly surprised, sort of, you know, yeah. Frightened, fragile.
Get Andy Gill with the Wonderments and see what we can, see what we can yeah. come up with.
But another thing about Smile is that it was meant to be a kind of an American Gothic type thing, because both he and Van Dyke were interested in American history, which is why you get all that kind of old cowpoke music coming in every now and then. And they really wanted it to reflect this American Gothic history thing. And I just wonder what he must have felt like when he heard the band's second album.
Yes.
Oh,
where,
yes.
Which comes along, and there it is, and it's not got these pristine harmonies at all. It's got these whiskery old, yeah. weather-beaten harmonies, and this music that sounds... Because basically the band were guys who lived that music. They yeah. lived all that R&B and that country and all those weird old musics in a way which the Wrecking Crew and, you know, and Brian and Van Dyke, for them it was a dilettante exercise.
Well, they were Californians.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
so I think, you know, if and when he heard the, you know, this band second album, he must have thought, oh, they've done it.
Is there a greater Greek tragedy than the Beach Boys? I give you, in hopefully under half a minute,
go on.
The death of Dennis. Dennis, let me just say very quickly, Dennis Wilson, who died at the age of 38, was married three times. He married his second wife twice in 2 years. Already we're getting into the realms of confusion that I can't possibly understand. His third wife was, unless I'm entirely mistaken, Andy, the illegitimate child of his cousin Mike Love.
Mike Love, yeah.
Yeah, that's going to go down really well at Christmas dinner, isn't it, right? A little bit more turkey and blueberry glaze. Oh, you're not here, because you weren't invited. Anyway, he's on the yacht in Marina del Rey, which he had with his third wife, the illegitimate child, etc. They've had a domestic. He remembers, he's full of drugs and drink, he remembers that this is the spot at this anchorage where he had a row with his second wife, which ended with him hurling at her the framed photograph of the two of them at their wedding.
And he dives in.
It smashes, it goes to the water, and because of the same anchor, he thinks, it must be down there. That's the girl I love.
Find it.
What am I doing with this? He dives in, you're absolutely right, brim full of drugs and drink. He arrives out of the water holding, like Excalibur, the broken frame, right, fails to get it back onto the boat, is seen underwater, swimming frantically, and never seen again.
Never seen again.
Isn't that a most extraordinary story? And that is just one member of this unbelievable...
In a way, it's extraordinary they never found the body, because Marina del Rey is a kind of a closed-in harbour.
Yeah.
It's a closed-in anchorage.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I don't think
never
they
found the body.
I don't think it did.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Somewhere down there in Marina del Rey is Dennis. Because it's unlikely
I'm
that...
I'm surprised nobody's come up with a conspiracy theory that he's
actually away living
and resurfaced.
In...
Because,
know.
Of course, there is the whole Dennis Wilson-Charles Manson story.
Yep.
Where Charles Manson turns up on... Dennis comes home one day...
With two girl hitchhikers,
With two girl hitchhikers.
Yeah, right, yeah,
fine judge of character, David.
Yeah.
and he has a great time with
he's
these two
girl
hitchhikers.
On board.
And then, yeah. then a short while after, these two girl hitchhikers come back with their mates.
How many was it? So 16? Or
something like that.
They brought 16 friends.
Like 20,
and they just live
people.
In his house.
And they're in his house, and one of them is this guy, Charlie, who's got this really weird stare. And first of all, you know, Dennis is, he's quite up for the group sex type of thing, and, you know, and all the drugs and so on. Yeah, he'll do that. Then, and this guy, Charlie, seems quite interesting and charismatic, and he writes songs as well. And,
he gets in with
and he
Terry
starts,
Melcher or something, doesn't he?
He gets a demo. Exactly, and he Dennis introduces him to Terry Melcher and so on. And
it's Terry Melcher's house?
It's Terry Melcher that they were going after when they got Sharon Tate, but he'd sold the house on to Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate by that time. But Dennis is just freaks... Dennis out eventually. He leaves his own house.
Eventually. Yeah.
Eventually, and has to get, you know, presumably bailiffs or someone to come and get the family out of the Mansons. And but later on, There's a song called, I think it's called, is it Learn Not...
Never Learn Not to Love.
Never Learn Not to Love.
Which is Charles Manson.
Which Charles Manson wrote, but never got any credit for.
It had another name, actually, when he wrote it. And they changed the name.
They changed the name.
Never Learn Not to Love. Yeah. It was called something else. I can't remember what name.
And this incensed...
Something like that?
Cease to Exist, it was called. Yes. Cease to Exist. And they turned it to Never Learn Not to Love.
10 points to Mr. Lurie.
Incensed Charlie Manson. And... But by that time, I guess he was in jail. So
the weather's a hit. There's a risk. The other thing I found this week, which I've never seen before, and I will post it on the site along with this podcast, is Mike Love's extraordinary speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame investiture in, I think, 2004, where the Beach Boys are invested into the Academy or whatever by Elton John, and somehow Mike Love gets on stage. Wearing a kind of the traditional baseball German. Clap.
No, right.
Yeah, not wearing
it. There was a stage
not
where the old Barnett was starting to go a bit. And he put a turban on.
I thought the turban was a good look.
Hairy face. It was a good look.
Mike Love. He used to follow the progress of Mike Love's hair.
By how many buttons he had undone
on the shirt to reveal his luxuriant hairy chest. And then it ultimately culminated in him turning up on stage wearing a sequined turban and no shirt.
No shirt at all.
It's like, all the hair is here, girls.
Don't go looking up there. Oh, it was great.
Anyway, he gets on stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's got Elton John, he's got Bob Dylan, he's got the usual great and the good there, and he just goes in this kind of completely deranged monologue about how, you know, I'm prepared to meet Mick Jagger anywhere, and he can bring his Jumpin' Jack Flash, and we'll bring our Get Around, and, you know, we'll see who can rock the most. We did 140 dates last year. And he's, you know, the room is just curling up with embarrassment.
This is hugely embarrassing.
I interviewed Mike Love once, and not the nicest guy I've ever interviewed, and he actually used the phrase "my cousin, the mental patient," I think,
or something
along those lines. It was, you know, and I just thought,
did he ever say about really? Cousin Dennis?
But he has, but he has successfully, hasn't he, sued Brian Wilson over credit on a load of those early songs?
And when you listen
to
them,
ruled in favour of it,
absolutely. And when you listen to those early songs, you think. Yeah, only Mike Love could have written those lyrics.
Right. So to finish this bit on the Beach Boys, watch one track of the Beach Boys, just what's one track you love. Andy?
God Only Knows.
God Only Knows. Okay, why? Anything
because it's just possibly, you know, the greatest love song ever written, and it's got a beautiful arrangement built on that accordion figure. And he wrote it and gave it to Carl, because Carl had never sung lead on one of their singles. And he gave Carl this lovely song.
No Greater Love.
Yeah, and it's just a you know, a transcendent moment. I think it's better than Good Vibrations. I think
same choice for me.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. I'm going to throw in one we were playing in the office the other day and noting the fact that it has an opening line with more syllables than any other I can think of in pop music, which is Don't Worry Baby, which starts with, it's been building up inside of me for I don't know how long. And if you listen to that, it just flows absolutely perfectly.
Another palindrome.
And with the melody.
Yeah, and that, of course, was the B-side of I Get Around.
Which is amazing to think.
What a fantastic single.
That's extraordinary. You know. What about you, Mark?
Well, those early ones, I Get Around, Sonny, I Help Me Rhonda, I remember very fondly. I still love that. It's just a brilliant little cyclical harmony part. Partly because I remember them playing it when I was a teenager, watching them in the rain on May the 29th, I think it was, 1972, in a place called Bardney in Yorkshire. Andy and I, who were pretty much exactly the same age, went to all the great festivals. We didn't know each other then. We were at Wheelie and all that, you know, when we were 16 or whatever. But you probably weren't at that one. You weren't there, were you?
I didn't see that one.
They came on after the Grease Band, Wishbone Ash, Monty Python's Flying Circus, and I think Slade.
I saw the Beach Boys at Wembley.
With Elton John?
With Elton John and the Eagles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, I saw that.
And they were great. I mean, you know.
Hot day, Andy, wasn't it? Hot day, we had no cover at all. We were out there on the pitch.
Terrible, yeah.
And I amused myself with a friend that in those days at the cup finals the sides used to come out at one end up a ramp, didn't they?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so me and a friend during bits of the show that we weren't very interested in particularly Elton John doing the whole of his Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy in sequence, as he did. We would go down this ramp and then wait for the end of a song and then come up the ramp just as the crowd were going... so we can pretend we're kind of, you know, Billy Bremner and George Graham or whatever.
They're taking photos of each other. Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. Very good.
Can I just add the least flattering assessment of a fellow musician?
Go on.
This comes from Brian's autobiography, Wouldn't It Be Nice? My own story. It's about Van Dyke Parks, and he said, merely asking what he did provoked any number of answers. He was a piano player, singer, songwriter, the wearer of any number of hats, a functionary, the leper with the most fingers.
Oh, my Lord. Well, lost there.
I missed him when he was in the pod, but you were enormously impressed with him, weren't you?
Oh, terribly impressed. He was absolutely... We had a very nice response to that, didn't we, Fraser?
We did,
No real effort required by either myself or you. He put on a show.
And he left his business card behind, didn't he? What did it say,
Fraser? Van Dyke Parks apologises for his behaviour on and then a gap for the day.
I've got it stuck to my computer. It just cheers me up every day.
It's great, man.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink, and it's like being in the pub.
So, in the news this week, Stone Roses reform. Are we excited, Andy?
I was never that much of a fan. I preferred Ian Brown's solo albums to the Stone Roses albums.
Oh, you contrary,
I thought The Second Coming was just terrible. Really.
Good songs on that. Oh, are you kidding? Oh. Breaking Into Heaven. Tears.
Oh, who says good songs with that defensive tone?
Yeah, you can't knock the Roses.
So Danny Baker always says, when people have a go at, you know, wretched albums, somebody always goes, oh, there's one good song.
One good song.
With exactly
you've
ever
written
tone.
Is that, you know.
So you're excited about Stone
very
Roses.
I adore the Stone Roses. Absolutely. I'm thrilled to bits.
And
I
they
really
sold allegedly £12 million worth of tickets in under an hour.
See, this is why bands will come back.
Probably
no, but they come back because when they broke up, how much were they paying? How much were people paying for a ticket?
Exactly,
15
yeah,
quid.
Yeah.
Would you like to be back in the days of £50 and £60? Yes, please.
Yeah.
I'll come back.
And I really like the quote from Ian Brown that accompanied the story of this extraordinary sellout ticket to bonanza, and he was quoted as saying, the rest of the band and I are planning to spend the rest of the days with our arms in the air jumping up and down. Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you?
You read the quote about Man City as well. I can't remember who it came from. One of the Stone Roses.
It was Manny, I think.
Yeah. Manny, Man City supporter. Because he'd said years ago in an interview, you know, there's about as much chance of Man City winning the league as there is the Stone Roses coming back
brilliant.
Together.
I wish
of course,
I'd
the likelihood
that.
Is that Man City could well win the Premiership.
Oh, I would have put that in a little piece about
and they get back together again. But, of course, they're not just touring. They're also, they've got some new songs. And
there's a great bit in the press conference where he said, someone says, have you got any new stuff? And Rennie goes, we've got 17 new stuffs. Rennie was the star of the show, by the way. Rennie, who never used to really say very much, was just absolutely pricelessly funny.
And what happened to Rennie? We know what happened to Manny. He went and joined Primal Scream. We know what happened to John Squire. He formed the Seahorses and then got into painting and made a pretty bad solo album. And we know what happened to Ian Brown. What happened to Rennie?
I really don't
brilliant
know.
Drummer.
Yeah, brilliant drummer.
One of those absolute signature licks.
A certain amount of sort of early
might
retirement.
Might have been bringing out family or
could
something
have
like it. Could have been doing something useful.
Yeah.
But anyway, they are they're going to record some new songs. And here's my question to the committee.
All right, come on.
Has there ever been a case of a reformed band writing and recording a song worth a damn?
Oh.
No.
Is that it? Andy Gill, short answer, no.
But who Crowley House reformed, Little Feet reformed.
Exactly.
Everybody's reformed. Magazine just made a great record.
The Birds
made a great
not a good
record.
Album.
So go on.
I've not heard the new Magazine.
It's very, very good. I mean, is it as good as Song from Under the Floor was? I don't know.
No,
I've got one for you, actually. I went to see, in Wembley Arena, in the year 2000, the reformed Steely Dan. And they had a record called Two Against Nature.
Two Against Nature was good.
And one of the tracks on that, in fact, anybody listening could do worse
Cousin Dupree.
To just have a look at your YouTube and get it up. It's called Jack of Speed. It's a fantastic jazz song.
So here's my supplementary.
I think that's almost, well, let's say for the sake of argument, it's as good as anything on that first album.
Well, this is very interesting you should say this, because I posed this question on Twitter the other day. Has any group reformed recorded the song which is good enough to displace any of their best 10 songs? Right?
In the way that Free as a Bird did by the Beatles.
Absolutely.
I know.
In the way that Free as a Bird booted Penny Lane into touch. Move over 8 days a week. So it was interesting that there was a kind of... There was a sort of hesitant silence from Twitter, from your Twitter nation. People going, what about... Oh, no.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe there's... No. And the only person who actually... Who argued, along with you, that Steely Dan were a case...
Oh, right, go on.
...was Dylan Jones of GQ.
Very good.
So Dylan Jones actually said... I can't remember which tracks he said, but he said a couple of their songs, their later songs... would displace their best 10. I'm still not sure about that. I think they might get into the best 30.
Maybe,
but I think you're going to try hard to go displace,
Cousin Dupree,
do it again or whatever.
Album was
that record's great. The whole record's good.
That was a decent comeback.
But it's a rare.
A lot of it's connected with
age, isn't
it?
I don't know if it would, if it knocks Can't Buy a Thrill and Countdown to Ecstasy.
No, I don't.
I think I'd still listen to all of those albums before I'd listen to any of...
There's just so bound up with the novelty of the sound and the age you are and the age they are at the time. There's so many things that inform your opinion. It's very hard to come from later in life and they're in their 60s or whatever and you're older and it doesn't matter so much and it's not new anymore. When I first heard Steely Dan, I'd never heard it. We've had this conversation before about the Beach Boys, about Good Vibrations, but I just hadn't ever heard anything like it. It was a form of jazz, but incredible instrumentation.
The same question could be asked of comebacks in general. Is there ever a comeback that's equivalent to, even
you
if
never
it's not
the
just
impact.
A... I don't know, I think there's one.
Go on.
Well, there's two, actually. Well, there's Bob, of course, who's done it several times.
But he never split up with himself, did he?
No, I don't mean split up, I mean comeback.
Okay,
Someone who goes out into the wilderness and comes back.
78, Bell's Court. Blackbush, in that era.
And I think also Leonard Cohen. I'm Your
Yes,
Man.
That's true.
Yes.
Up there with his...
Yes, better records than his earlier ones, probably.
Yeah, probably. I also think 10 New Songs is a fantastic record as well.
Yes, it is.
But there's something about group records. You go back to your Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you go and listen to early Steely Dan. The tracks are relatively short.
Yeah.
And they just have an energy and an exuberance about them. Mm. And as people get older... the tracks get longer and get longer to get to their point, as if the person making them, and it kind of relates to what we're saying about Brian Wilson earlier on, they kind of lose that confidence that they had when they were younger.
It's their confidence. I was in the car the other day and I was playing, I'm going through a bit of a Duke Ellington phase. I was playing this lovely Duke Ellington composition. It has a track on it, which I don't need to tell you which one it is. It's East St. Louis Toodaloo. And when you listen to the original version of that, I can't remember what album Steely Dan did it on.
Pretzel Logic.
They did a version of this, which is absolutely faithful to the original. They actually miss out a 16-bar section in the middle, fact fans. But they managed to emulate with wah-wah pedal guitars, the brilliant trumpet and sax solos.
Bubba Miley's
It's amazing. It's so complicated. And they must have looked at that. Partly, A, they love jazz. But B, it's an academic exercise, which is all these rock musicians playing their... songs in A minor, you know what I mean? Going to F. Yeah. We're going to do a Duke Ellington arrangement in the studio, note perfect. It's fantastic.
I was reading a Clive James thing, and I've forgotten which book it's from. He's written a book of a kind of survey of 20th century culture. I can't remember what it is.
He's
appreciations of all kinds of people, and he's big Duke Ellington fan. He writes about Duke Ellington.
That's extraordinary stuff.
And Duke Ellington is a kind of classic case of what we're talking about with rock, actually, in that everything he did early was short, to the point, tuneful. And then when he became the legend Duke Ellington in his 60s and 70s, he couldn't get started unless he was doing something that was vaguely symphonic, or something that came in many movements, or something that involved something he'd never used before, and that he didn't know how to go back and use the original palette. Everything got very ponderous later on, and he's no less the genius, But just something about that kind of early form.
I couldn't agree more. And also, even the titles of the songs had a very specific point to them. You probably work from the title first. There's one called Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, which is obviously to try to capitalise on, or rather start, actually, the whole kind of swing.
Well, it's Playing for Dancers.
And it's just fantastic. And it's just a brilliant 3-minute composition to just drive people completely insane on a dance floor. You know, it was great lyric.
And I think also that you're right about Duke Ellington. And I think part of, it's the same thing. It's the genius thing. Coming back later in life, he was all acclaimed, and he knew that he was a genius.
I'm supposed to be a genius.
People had been telling him
he'd better do something. So who else is a genius? I know. Yeah. Beethoven, he was a genius.
Yeah, exactly.
I better do
Where's
something that's a little bit like that.
Where's my sandbox? Where's my treehouse? Back to that again.
So the only act we can think of who might have done something in their reform state that might pass muster alongside the best stuff is Steely Dan.
I think so.
So if anybody would like to, you know...
Take
issue with this, add in their candidates. wordmagazine.co.uk is the place to do it. Another thing that's been taking place on the site in the last week is started the conversation in the office, which is a very important issue. Who's got, who has had, at any point, the longest hair in rock?
This conversation
started off with Mark Ellen nominating somebody whose name will not be revealed until later on.
Yeah.
Because in the white envelope, I've written down who Mark Ellen said has got the longest hair in rock.
I have to say, I'm confident that it was the right answer. So I'm very surprised.
Andy Gill is going to open this in a while after we've gone through the runners and riders. So, Fraser, I think you've...
By the way, this was male, actually, to be fair, when we decided.
Crystal Gale was disqualified.
Probably Alanis Morissette showed the winner.
But Fraser has got some pictures of the various candidates. Oh, are you passing them to me?
Okay.
One over there.
So, we're all looking at the same thing, right? Great. And he's cut out the one.
Cut out the one who... Oh, my God, so, who the hell is now, that? Oh, that worries me.
We're looking at...
Josh Winter of Typo Negative.
We'll put these on the website so you can go and look at these.
Well, I
Josh Winter of Typo Negative is an extraordinary kind of exploding sofa of hair.
Oh,
the hair goes out of shot.
This guy from I Fear, Dave Ciccati. That's extraordinary.
It's to his feet, isn't it?
It's to his feet.
I am feet. Are you sure it's not extensions?
He must have somebody following behind him, actually, carrying his train.
He's in a death metal band. They won't be extensions.
It looks like he's wearing a really cool...
death metal groups don't do anything.
It looks like a room divider, doesn't it? As if you could part that hair and go through and get something from the pantry.
A beaded curtain.
Yeah, a beaded curtain.
Damien Marley is down here representing the Dread fraternity.
I was going to say, I would have thought it would have been a Dread fraternity, because, let's face it, it squiggles up as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. It's like telephone cord.
If you got behind him and you pulled one...
Absolutely.
Long, you would probably find it would be as long as Dave Ciccati's.
Ciccati, he would show Ciccati.
And Herman Lee of Dragon Force, he could pretty much tuck it in his belt there, couldn't he? He put it in his back pocket there. So, anybody else you'd want to suggest, Andy? Anybody we've forgotten?
Well, I bow to two or three of these. These are extraordinary.
Anybody with particularly remarkable rock hair you think should go?
I was just thinking of there was some guy in Blue Cheer that used to have long hair.
Oh.
And things like this. And,
you mean the authors of Vinci Bus Eruptum?
Or should it not be pronounced Wincabus Eruptum?
Oh,
I mean, good.
I mean, God has all the Latin pronunciation of an ancient heavy metal album.
You're listening to the Word again. Podcast. You know you are. Where else are you going to hear this kind of quality banter, people?
But also,
there was a guy in a group called Extreme. I remember, like, Nuno somebody.
Nuno Bettencourt.
I remember meeting him at a Smash Hits Pop Winners poll party. With my two kids, when they were 8 and 10, and we have a great photograph of us with Kylie Minogue, and I also have a great picture of us with this guy. But we didn't know who he was. He just came over and thought, "Hey, let's just got long hair." You know, I don't know. So Nuno, what his name was, he had very long hair. But I'll be absolutely honest with you now. When Andy's going to have to open this envelope, but I'm feeling less confident because this guy, although I could only find a picture of him. In my defence, he had hair almost from his waist, but it appeared there was going to be lots more.
I'm handing the envelope now to Andy Gill. You can open what this is the name of the person there.
Well, when
Mark Ellen
this was the longest hair in rock.
The longest hair in rock.
Legend.
Here we go, Andy. You want to read this?
And the winner is Artemus Pyle of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
You know it! You know it, people! Artemus Pyle! Anybody listening, if you're near a computer, go and have a look. Just Google images. Check it out.
I don't
oh
think
Oh, my
that's
God,
that
he had
that
long hair. As did Alice Cooper's backing band, actually, in about 1974. There we are.
You see, I don't think anybody has...
Compared to a bit, I've lost this.
Yeah, I think nowadays, long hair is longer, isn't it, Fraser?
This is
yeah.
like if you were tattooed in the 70s, you don't have as many tattoos
this
as you
is
do.
It.
Oh,
current,
okay.
This is it!
The same applies to everything.
Well, Dave...
Long hair then is not as long as long
life
hair now.
Here is one. Yeah. There's no question yeah, about right. that.
Talking about tattoos, you must see, if you get the Word newsletter, that fantastic Fraser's... posted a wonderful trailer to a new documentary called what, Fraser? I can't remember.
Is Animal Phobia? Is that the one?
No, I'm talking about the one about punks now in
oh,
their
yes.
40s and 50s.
Oh,
the other F word.
Oh, what's
it called?
The other F word.
The other F word. And this is a wonderful documentary made about guys who used to be really hardcore punks back in the day and are now in their 40s and 50s and raising children. And it's about the challenges of raising children when you've got kind of rings through your nose and, you know...
And a spider web tattoo.
But they're
it.
All Absolutely. Completely covered. And there's one lovely bit, I can't remember who he is now, some guy's got a little kid, he's, you know, in a carry cot or something and can't sleep at night. And there they are being cradled in these arms that are covered in transvestites. Am I right? Does he have two transvestites on his arm? And at one point he says, it's kind of hard to explain that to the kids, but, you know, there you go.
I really want to see that film.
Oh, it's brilliant.
It looks really interesting. Mm. So,
covered in transvestites. Of course. What else?
So we should post these. We should post these extraordinary long hairs. Did we mention David Allan Coe? The
I don't think we did.
The country singer, songwriter, Rhinestone Cowboy.
Oh, really?
Isn't he the Rhinestone Cowboy?
Well, did he write Rhinestone Cowboy? No.
I seem to remember the name David Allan Coe. Or is he the legendary Stardust Cowboy?
I don't think
that's the one different. Oh, he did Willie Waylon and Me. It was his big country touch.
Right. And now he does very kind of rabid. Right
yes.
wing.
Yes.
Kind of
nasty piece of work.
But extraordinary, yeah. extraordinary yeah. hair. What else have we got? And, oh, yes, various posts from the website, which I'm just going to read one, actually, which is my favourite from the last few weeks. It's somebody talking about, I can't remember how this thread came along.
What's the most expensive gig you've ever been to?
Most expensive gig you've ever been to. What's the most expensive gig you've ever been to?
There's a couple. There was the Led Zepp reunion.
Right.
Which was about 135, including the ticket fee and so on.
Right, right.
And but I think, was that more expensive or less expensive than the Cream reunion?
I was at the Cream as well. I was both of those. Yeah, Cream was 125 quid. Yeah. We've done this on podcasts passing, but I remember the moment when there was a song you didn't like. It was like being in a black cab. Because I'd worked out that if you went into a black cab and said, keep driving for 2 hours, 10 minutes, which is how long the concert was, the bill at the end would be 125 quid.
Yeah.
So when they started playing Press Rad and Walk On, I was like, that's 15 quid gone. I'm not enjoying this.
Although, you know, I must admit, I preferred that Cream to the early days.
So did I.
I thought they were
better,
much better players.
No, much better group.
They were much,
far better group.
And whereas Toad in the early days was, I'm sorry, I'm not playing that.
Yeah.
You know, it's 17 minutes of my life that I don't want to give up.
Yeah.
To actually see Ginger Baker playing hitting five different things in less than a second.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary.
At the age of 68 or whatever it was.
To actually make these kind of strange arm movements that produce this many.
Actually, talking about gigs that were less than harmonious, there's other thing that was posted in the email newsletter this week is the link to the extraordinary story of Neil Finn, Ryan Adams, and Janice Ian doing the songwriters circle thing.
Oh right, with the BBC.
Which I'm very sad I didn't go to. I was supposed to go. I couldn't go. And, you know, these things the BBC do where they get three songwriters.
It was broadcast very recently.
It was broadcast very recently. I think what you didn't see...
Heavily edited, what you
say? I don't know about heavily edited. But you've been to one of these.
I've been to several. I like them very
and
much.
So you've got three guys, you know, songwriters sitting on stools, you know, and they talk about songwriting and they play their best-known tunes. And then they're supposed to do a certain amount together. Well, apparently, they were supposed to do Neil Finn's, I can't remember which song it was, I can't remember, and they were supposed to do it together, and they had to re-record it or something because there was something wrong with the sound. And Ryan Adams made his displeasure absolutely plain And I think he was kind of texting and so forth while he was supposed to be joining in.
That's
with
very
song.
Disrespectful.
And there was,
really,
there
yeah.
was, you
that's
know,
rude.
There was, you know, harsh words were exchanged on stage. And so there's been a huge follow up to it on an Australian website, which into which loads of people like Ryan Adams and Janice Ian have weighed in with their five penneth, you know, because
excellent.
Nowadays with YouTube and everything, you know, everything follows you around forevermore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
that's true.
Do enjoy yourself on that particular tale.
Yeah.
Anyway,
good.
The story going
what's
back
the
to
answer to the
this is about expensive. Somebody going to see Tom Waits and was actually got tickets through the late Rob Partridge.
Yeah.
You know, so he was in the kind of privileged bit. We arrived to find our row of seats. This is from Pocket Calculator. We arrived to find our row of seats somewhat empty. Bloody journos, I said. Around us were several famous faces. Tom York, Damon Albarn and the like. Just before the show, the door that leads backstage from the auditorium opened and out walked Johnny Depp, Vanessa Paradis, Tim Burton and Helena Bonham Carter, Jerry Hall and a few others, he says, you know. Says they trooped up and joined us on our row, Depp sitting next to my by now trembling wife. This is the best bit. Evening, ma'am, he said, and doffed his tipfer. She came, I think.
Oh, no!
Oh, no! Oh, that was very good.
Very
good.
Very funny.
We can't leave without Fraser, just briefly. Fraser's been away for a month at the World Cup and visiting long-lost relations down in New Zealand. And we haven't had a full catch-up, really, Fraser, since you've been back. So it's been very, very busy. Went to loads of games and so forth. Went to the final.
Yep.
Saw Wales.
Yeah. I don't think Fraser enjoyed the final quite as much as we enjoyed it at home. You know,
it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
We were sitting at home going, oh, this is nice. We don't care who wins, but it's a fantastic game.
I've never experienced an atmosphere of fear like that
really?
Before. Yeah.
Really? So what are the things at the World Cup that we miss because we only watched it on telly?
Well, I think what you don't get an idea of is absolutely how wrapped up New Zealand is in the whole tournament and how important it is, and the fact that the papers will be filled with it from beginning to end, but it's never about the personalities of the players or whatever they've been doing in the part-time, which is what you get here. It's all about rugby, about the game. And you had things like when Dan Carter was injured, the nation mourned. They had I saw a TV special where they'd got a grief counsellor on.
No!
To help the nation.
No!
Over
to hold
injury.
The nation's
hand. Oh, that's brilliant.
And the first thing he said was, I'm not usually here till later in the tournament.
Oh, no!
So he obviously does this thing regularly where he helps everyone through the terrible state of the All Blacks.
In the end, that didn't matter, did it?
It didn't
fourth,
matter.
Fourth
yeah.
choice.
But also, you were saying yesterday that it was quite controlled. That it was only when they got to the semi-final
the New Zealanders started to semi-final.
Because they were worried they might go out.
I think so.
Probably,
I think there was a huge fear of losing to Australia because they'd lost them recently in the Tri Nations. And the Australians kicked off and Quade Cooper put the ball into touch and Eden Park erupted.
I've never seen anything like it.
It was extraordinary. And that was the turning point.
So this is, for those who don't follow the game very closely, Quade Cooper is a New Zealander.
He's a New Zealander, yeah.
Who plays for Australia.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know.
He's the
and, the enmity between New Zealanders and Australians is something we just cannot
understand. Makes relations between Canadians and Americans seem quite cordial.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the direction of the TV coverage of this was basically one camera was on Quade Cooper all the way through, just praying that he screwed up, wasn't it?
And
which he did quite a few
screwed,
times.
Yeah,
and you can see, it's always my favourite sight on sporting on TV. You can always see how people blush. You know, people do something wrong on a sporting field with the cameras on them. They are blushing. They're colouring up because they know they've got that level of attention.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. And, of course, you were there at the final for the hacker business where the French actually approached the...
As they should be allowed to do, I think.
Quite
it's a challenge.
Right.
I mean, the IRB say it's disrespectful to challenge them. Okay, it's nothing to do with disrespect. It's about them.
I thought they were going to break into their own song.
They don't want people scrapping before the kickoff.
No,
why they don't let people.
Because they linked arms and stood up in front of them. And I thought they were going
to
get
able to
start playing Pourboire by Plastic Bertrand. That's not French, actually. It's Belgian, sorry.
The thing that got me, the clever thing about their timing was they didn't move forward until New Zealanders were halfway through the hacker.
Yeah.
And it must have slightly thrown them.
Yeah.
You're leaping in the air. You're kind of doing throat-slitting gestures, and suddenly Johnny Frenchman started moving.
Yeah.
What's he about to do?
Yeah.
It must slightly throw you.
Johnny Frenchman's lit a high-tar cigarette.
takes out onion.
Gets out of bed.
What do you think the England team would have used as their if they were to respond with a
well? They famously,
a musical
thing. Well, I don't know about a musical. Famously, years ago, was it Richard Cockerell actually approached Norm Hyatt, Norm Hewitt, didn't he, and went nose to nose with him. Which is probably going a little far. Yeah.
I think they could do. Who do you think you're kidding, Mister?
Yeah, Hersham Boys,
the Floral Dance,
or the Archers theme tune.
That'd be good.
Very good. That's what Billy Connolly suggested ought to be the national anthem, didn't he?
And you know, ever since he said that, every time I hear the Archers theme tune, I think that is a really good anthem.
Yeah. It's not too late for the Olympics, is it?
You've been listening to The Word Podcast. If you've enjoyed it, we would really appreciate it if you would take the time to rate it on iTunes. You can find many more Word Podcasts at wordpodcast.co.uk. And if you'd like to come to one of our Word in Your Ear live events, then you can find details at wiyelondon.com or just Google us. Thanks for listening.